The Talk of the Northwest. The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine. It's Wednesday, the 15th of July, 2026, and we're broadcasting once again from a very dry, a very sunny northwest of Ireland. We've been keeping you informed, both here in Highland and on my own socials as well, of water restrictions, overnight water restrictions. Well, I wanted to get the full picture, and I told you yesterday, so Irish Water will join us a little later on to let us know what the crack is in terms of whose water is restricted, what restrictions may be coming down the line. I know there's a lot of frustration out there because we get a lot of rain here, right? And it hasn't been dry for that long, and here we are. But we can only work with the reality on the ground, so we'll have that for you. We've got some advice a little later on too on how to best protect your skin and that of your loved ones in this drier spell. That and so much more besides. Maybe you want to talk about the game tonight. Who are you going to be supporting? Think for a second now. Who are you going to be supporting? So RTE will have record figures tonight. This will be the most watched game of the World Cup so far. You can just take that to the bank. And many of you will choose to watch the BBC or ITV coverage because you might prefer the commentary or whatever it might be. But who do you want to win? Is it Argentina or is it England? You will have watched, many of you will have watched the big occasions in games between these two teams in the past. The Hand of God, as it was called. David Beckham's red card, do you remember that big controversy? Lionel Messi's never played against England. This is probably and potentially could be his last international game. So there's a lot going on there. And Lee asked me just as we kicked over to the news, well, who do you want to win, Greg? And I was like, well, I mean, obviously there is that rivalry between Ireland and England. But then I was thinking, you know, what final am I more likely to watch or actually sort of want? Is it Spain-Argentina? Or is it Spain-England? I don't know. What do you think? Anyway, who would you like to win? Now, a lot of people make the argument too that, well, of course you have to support England because so many people here support the Premiership. And if you support the Premiership, well, then you have to back England. But the Premiership's the Premiership or the Premier League is an international competition now. I mean, many of you out there support Manchester United. How many regular English first teamers does Manchester United have? Two. Four maybe sometimes in some games, but it's two generally. Liverpool, another big team here, they can often just field one English player in their starting 11. So this notion that because you support the Premiership, you should support England, well, the reality is that is an international league hosted in England. So whilst you're watching an English game, all the players, the majority are not English. So how many would you say of the starting 11s for last season were domestic players is what we should call them, shouldn't it? So how many of them were? What percentage? 70%? 75%? 80%? No, 30%. 31% of starting 11s last season in the Premiership had domestic players in them. And some teams are making up more than others. Some teams, there was many, many teams started with one English player. So this notion that you must support England because you watch the Premiership is a load of nonsense. That's an international league based in England now. But anyway, as I said, which final would I prefer to see? I think I'd prefer to see Spain versus England because that's the one I'd be more inclined to watch because you know the players better and there's just it's just more fun whether you want them to lose or win. Do you know what I mean? But what do you think? How do you think the game's going to go tonight? I just thought because having watched France last night, I thought there's no way those guys can be beaten by this Spanish team that really I don't feel had turned up. And yet Spain were fantastic and France were useless. Absolutely. But I say that in sport in terms. I'm not a professional footballer. You know what I mean? In terms of how they played. But anyway, we've got that and I'll give you the numbers. And if you want to talk about that, that's fine too. Right, on to the newspapers. Let's start with the Irish Independent because police located the bodies of three relatives who were found dead in a County Antrim home after they received a call for a sudden death. It's emerged in an update. Midden East Antrim District Commander Superintendent William Calderwood said they were met with a shocking scene when they arrived at the house in Ballymena. Earlier yesterday, it was confirmed that the three relatives who were found dead in Ballymena were Polish. It is being treated as a murder-suicide. The three, a man 41, woman 39 and girl just 8, were found inside the family home in the old Collybackie Road area of the County Antrim town on Monday. Mid and East Antrim District Commander Superintendent William Calderwood said they wished to reiterate there is no risk to the public. So an awful, awful situation that has emerged there. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and the Labour Party is denied attacking the press for coverage of falsehoods that emerged in the story of Galway Mayor's Helen Ogbu's arrival in Ireland. A press release the party issued after the Irish Daily Mail knocked on Miss Ogbu's door to get her account 3 days after the paper sent queries to the Labour press office without response, branded the newspaper's actions intimidatory and unacceptable. It continued, "The Labour Party wishes to express our serious concern at the tactics used by a mainstream media outlet, particularly at a time when far-right agitation is becoming increasingly evident across our communities." Now, I think that's a bit of a leap from the Labour Party there, because you can't use one concern you have to try and stop the press doing the job that the public who buy the papers, all five of them, that they want the papers, or they expect the papers to do. Ms. Olga's website, which carried the false claim, was deleted between the paper's initial inquiries and the knock on the mayor's door, but still the Mail received no response to their queries. On to the Irish Times now, and as is predictable now as anything, we talked yesterday about Donald Trump introducing 20% fees on cargo passing the Strait of Hormuz, and I think I was quite sceptical of its validity yesterday. Well, he's already abandoned those plans, and he's got himself in a real problem here in the Middle East because he can't get out. US President Donald Trump has said he will drop his demand for a 20% fee on cargo passing through the Strait of Hormuz as the United States and Iran fight for control of the critical waterway. Trump said on his Truth Social platform yesterday that instead of a fee which he had expected Gulf allies to pay, the countries would invest in the US, and based on highly productive conversations with Middle East leadership, he said, "I've decided to replace the 20% United States reimbursement fee with trade and investment deals that the various Gulf states will be making into the United States," Trump wrote. And the U-turn came hours in advance of the scheduled reimposition of the US military blockade against ships transitioning Iranian ports and coastal areas. Well, that is still in place. It's just this nonsensical 20%. It didn't make much sense. The Finn Valley Voice is out today. Dáil Éireann shuts up shop for the summer tomorrow, and the Dáil short-term letting bill designed to crack down on the Airbnb industry now goes into limbo until autumn. The news comes as a relief to Airbnb hosts all over Donegal who have become highly dependent on Airbnb income over summer. The government short-term letting bill, already delayed for years because of turf battles between government departments, now goes on to the autumn session, and sources say a policy framework is agreed and the Department of Enterprise will proceed with drafting the legislation, but room for further negotiations has now been created. It's a complicated one because it's only in certain areas and populations of certain sizes and so on and so forth. So thankfully, because I can't get my head around it, that's parked until the autumn. I think this is going to be one of those where if you don't have an e-scooter, you don't see the benefit of e-scooters, you don't have anyone in your life has an e-scooter, you probably would be in favour of an all-out ban because it doesn't really put you up or down. There are, and it's probably going to be a minority of people that have become quite reliant on them, you know, for commuting to work, commuting to college, getting around without having to cycle. But unfortunately, e-scooters are being abused and misused and are leading to an awful lot of hospitalizations. Now, I really wish if you're getting an e-scooter, you know, you should get the helmet and maybe the elbow pads, the knees pads or whatever. But we're not doing that seemingly because you never see them. You never see them on. But then they're not mandated. So anyway, so rather than trying e-scooters with better enforcement, insisting that helmets are worn, insisting maybe that there's some sort of a training, even a 2 or 3 day training for people who turn 16 and want to use them, or anyone for that matter. So in case of instead of doing that, we kind of introduced them with no rules and said, look, they're the same as bikes. And now there's talk of a total ban on e-scooters. So we've tried nothing in between. So I don't know what your views are on this. Maybe you're just glad to see them off the road. Maybe you don't care. But as I say, if you don't use them yourselves or no one in your life uses them, well, then you're not really going to care if they're banned altogether, are you? But I'll throw it out and see if there's a conversation there to be had. Taoiseach Micheál Martin wants to bring in an all-out ban on e-scooters in Ireland. It comes as the parents of teenager Grace Lynch called on the government to wake up and enforce the ban on scramblers. Grace, 16, died after she was hit by one of the bikes while crossing the road in Finglas, Dublin in January. Her parents, Siobhan and Martin, have campaigned to end the scourge of scramblers and e-scooters on our roads since then. The government introduced Grace's law in April, which banned the use of scramblers on public roads and in public parks. And I think we can all get on board with that. There's no real function of a scrambler unless it's to sort of have the crack, you know, with obviously in times very serious consequences. Well, Grace's parents appeared before the Oireachtas Justice Committee yesterday, and they've been doing fantastic advocacy work. But Micheál Martin said he would like to see e-scooters join scramblers in an all-out ban from our roads. He said the government will consider more extreme measures to tackle scramblers if the current ban does not work. Now, I just don't understand why these two issues are being taken together. But anyway, maybe it's something you care about, maybe it's something you don't. A teenaged disability activist has begun her third 50-hour protest outside Leinster House over the delay families face in accessing assessment of needs for children. Cara Darmody, 15, was greeted by politicians, including Sinn Féin leader Marilyn MacDonald, as she began her demonstration in Dublin yesterday. Cara, who prepares for her mission by camping at home, said her latest protest was sparked by the growing list of children waiting for an AON. She said the first time she held a sleepout protest last May, there were 15,000 children waiting for an assessment of need, while the number of children waiting is at now 21,792. That's a huge increase. And she's holding a sign in the papers today: stop breaking the assessment of needs law. A very direct message. And relatives of a man being treated as a person of interest in the Jamie Carney murder probe says he's innocent until proven guilty. Authorities in Jordan now have up to 15 days to question Ahmed Al-Sakar after he was arrested upon entering the country in recent days. Mr. Al-Sakar is being treated by Gardaí as a person of interest after he left Ireland in the hours before his girlfriend, Miss Carney, was discovered dead in her home in Killarney, County Kerry, last Tuesday. Now, a statement shared on social media by a family member has hit out to what it claims is a campaign of negative comments. Well, sorry. And I don't know what member of that family put that out there. He could have stayed and helped Gardaí with their inquiries at the very least, couldn't he? Now, I'm joined on the programme by Michelle. Good morning to you, Michelle.
Good morning, Greg.
Thanks so much for chatting to me. I'm good. Now, we're speaking about your advocacy for your sister, Moira Byrne, who is 48. Tell us Moira's situation, please.
I suppose Moira has special needs. She's intellectual disabilities. She was born like this. She attended the Central Remedial Clinic for the first 5 years of her life. She had intensive physiotherapy. She couldn't walk or talk. She then proceeded on to Kappa Hospital, where she was there until she was 12 or 13. She had two spinal operations on her spine. She has severe S curvature of the spine, it's scoliosis, and she walks with bended knees, and she needs assistance, both her physical needs, every day.
And I presume your parents, both of your parents, were a great support in supporting and caring for Moira throughout her life. But very sadly, you lost both your mum and dad relatively recently.
Yeah, in 2021, we lost my mum to breast cancer, and my father developed dementia-like symptoms, and he passed away there last November.
I'm sorry, so, Michelle. It's awful losing your parents. Now, Moira does live independently with an awful lot of support from you. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm an unpaid carer to my sister. She lives next door to me. She is in a local day centre here in West Donegal, and I had to recruit. I suppose 3 months after my dad died, I heard from the services. It took 3 months for them to contact us. It took me 7 months to secure funding for her. It was a HSE home support grant. It's 200 a week with 10 euros an hour, but I suppose the minimum wage in Ireland is 14.10 for any individual, and you have to recruit the carers yourself using that grant.
Now, of course, so you're going to have to top that up, or it's very limited hours, one or the other. And you yourself, Michelle, had to give up your career effectively to become an unpaid carer for your sister.
Yeah, I was working. I've been working for the last 25 years in pharmaceuticals. I was supposed to be in quality control, and it became too much for me in 2000. I think in 2024, I was looking after my father who had dementia and my sister with scoliosis and medical conditions. And I suppose anybody out there would know dealing with somebody with dementia is quite a difficult day to day. Yeah. That was
Yeah,
it.
okay. So, I mean, you're also looking for support or a plan going forward. I mean, first and foremost, the grant that you're receiving is a borderline insult in support of you who has had to give up your own career to care for your sister. And of course, there's no income from that. So this is a huge impact on you. And I suppose between your care for Michelle and then your care for your father, you're sacrificing so much yourself. But the state's not really backing you up. And God forbid if something were to happen to you, Michelle, whereby you were unable to provide the care for Maura, what is the situation?
I suppose that's where I became involved with a campaign called Before We Die. There are a group of people that I found were in a similar situation to myself. So I didn't feel alone. I didn't feel isolated. I didn't feel down, and I felt supported by this group. And it's growing every day. More people are becoming aware of it and they are joining it. And I suppose I think what I'm hoping for is a long-term plan for my sister and a sustainable and appropriate residential care close to her home in her community here in West Donegal, and a package to help her live at home before she goes into that residential care. And I suppose in her day centre, there's no canteen and no nurse since COVID, and that hasn't been reinstated. So I think these are people with intellectual disabilities. They're vulnerable adults who need to be getting one meal a day when they come to work, and a nurse, I suppose, to help with their disabilities and their complex medical needs, and a residential home, I suppose, goes to the day centre.
Yeah, but just like. Unfortunately, I'm not when it's the reality. Like I would have spoken to an awful lot of, and it's often parents, Michelle, and other members of the family. But it's often parents, and maybe they're in their mid 40s, 50s, and their children could be late teens or what have you. And what keeps them up at night is not the sacrifices that they're making. It's not the struggles to get services or struggles to get respite. It's actually what happens if something happens to me? And how could we be in a situation where, you know, that's how you're living your life to the point where you've had to become a campaigner in that regard? Like, there's a serious gap there, isn't there?
Yeah, I worry for my daughter as well. So I have a very young daughter, and I worry if I died in a few years' time and were still alive, would the caring of my sister go to her then, you know? And I would tell her to emigrate. Because I think predominantly carers in Ireland are women, and I don't think the government do enough to allow women to care for family members and work at the same time. I think also, yeah, I've given up a lot, and I've inherited my parents' worry of what happens tomorrow when I die, because it took 3 months for the services to kick in when my father passed away. So, I wouldn't want anybody else to inherit this lived experience.
As much as we can determine, and we simply don't know, perhaps we don't know, but if you were to just go now, Michelle, as horrible as that expression would be, what happens to Maura? Like, what would happen right now if you just disappeared off the face of the earth?
I suppose they asked her private care, one of her private carers. We only have four, and it's very few hours we have. It's very sparingly. That's why I'm not paid, because the money goes towards paying for Maura's carers in the house. I asked her what would happen, and she said she would stand in, but I suppose she's not related, a family relation. And there is nobody else, only me. So I don't know. I hope the state, that I suppose that's why I'm looking for this long-term residential care plan and a residential home. Like I see there in Gweedore that there's a Raya Canal, and it's a new estate, and part of the planning permission is a 5-bed group home.
Yeah, and that seems to be, that would be the future, you would hope, but I mean, there's one or two scattered here and there.
Yeah, I don't know if it's being built, and I know the HSE have to provide a wraparound service. Are they going to provide that wraparound service? And that's only for five people with intellectual disabilities in West Donegal, or anywhere in Donegal. Like, I've heard of a story, there were an ID adult, his parents were in the 80s, and he got moved to Tipperary, which is 100 kilometres away from home, and his parents were in their 80s, and they're not able to go and visit him. So
But this is like looking for thousands. I think there's going to be thousands of family members affected by this. You see, when we talk about services for people that require, you know, a great deal of additional care, it's often focused on younger people, Michelle, as you would understand, right? So it's about getting assessments, or it's about getting school places or the appropriate school setting, or what happens when, you know, someone's 18 or 19. But a lot of those people will be listening saying, well, you know, this is what's ahead of us here. You know, we're going to be 70, 75 at some stage. You know, our daughter or son could be 40, 45. You know, we might get an illness. We could die, God forbid. You know, so the fact that we don't really, or do we, have a plan anywhere in this country is really quite shocking. Is there any part of the country that's doing well, Michelle, or is this a nationwide campaign?
No, this is a nationwide campaign. I thought it was just with certain counties, but I don't think so, no. I was shocked when I seen that it's Dublin. I've heard of people in Dublin, down south, Galway, Cork, because I'm from Cork myself, so I would hear a lot of these stories. But I suppose when Maura was born, she couldn't walk or talk. She was like a floppy doll. And but through intensive physiotherapy and the remedial clinic and the services were there for her, she is, you know, today she can use her iPad. She looks up EasyJet online. She tracks the planes from Dublin up to Donegal. She's always watching the Oireachtas when she's crafting and making rugs. And to look at her when she was born, you wouldn't think those things were possible.
Oh, she defied all expectations, didn't she?
Yeah, and she's fighting still for her independence and for the services that she needs from the government. And I suppose I'd say to all parents out there with children with intellectual disabilities, you know, it's worth the fight, because she is the person today that she is. She's independent. She likes the odd cocktail. She's out in her local community, and she's a social butterfly, and she works in a local shop. So she wants to be counted, you know, she wants that independence and a place called.
Yeah. In the here and now, Michelle, and I know this conversation is about Maura, and I know that she, as you've just outlined, is an active member of society, don't get me wrong, but in terms of for yourself, I mean, obviously you've given up you left your 16-year career to be a caregiver. Just in terms of time for yourself, you talked about flights and EasyJet. I mean, can you get away, you know, if there's a wedding or something, can you attend on your own? Or, you know, like, what are the supports like for you as a carer in terms of giving you a break or respite?
I found more support when I was dealing with my father with dementia. I have a WhatsApp group and I was able to reach out to family carers, the Dementia Society. But in relation to my sister, there's not as many supports out there. I came across a disabled persons organization. It was run by a girl called Pippa, and she was able to put me in touch with other service. But I suppose in relation to holidays, they have to be really planned. I have to have a lot of carers there, and everything has to be organized before I go away. I don't think we're going to be going away now until next year because a lot of people are carers are taking holidays, her services are taking holidays, and we can't go off when they're off.
And that's
I
eating
suppose.
into memories with your own daughter as well. And this is not, this is just a fact of life. I know you're willingly helping your sister, don't get me wrong, but inevitably other relationships have to, as with the best will in the world, have to be compromised.
I suppose I've been doing this all my life. I've been doing this since the age of six onwards. I've always come home at weekends. I was over in university over in Bangor in Wales. And when I finished my degree, I had to come back because my parents wanted me close to home, I suppose, to look after my sister. It's always going to be my role. I suppose back in my 20s, I wondered what it was going to be like, but I never imagined that it was going to be this hard. And this fighting for everything that my sister needs and going on radio is either. I didn't factor that into
No.
the equation either.
And ironically, even while you're in the midst of what you're doing and this lifelong role as a carer, really the real function of this conversation, you're actually planning for when you're not there or not able to do what you're doing. And so, I mean, you know, you're planning to effectively beyond your own capabilities, which is unfortunate that we have to do this still, because this would require even a minister with specific responsibilities in this area to say that, you know what, society is judged best by how it treats its, you know, most vulnerable citizens, its older citizens. You can really tell how wealthy we are, you know. And then you hear the government talk of, and they're not lying when they say, you know, we are a wealthy country with a good economy. And I balk at it every time I hear it. And because of conversations like this, we're not wealthy. We're not the reason, if we have any money in reserve, it's because we're not spending it. You know, we're not spending it where it needs to be spent, like putting in long-term plans for for having in greater supports, or at least an income for you in what you're doing, you know. So how could you ever describe, how could this country ever be described as wealthy when we're not spending money on what should be seen as the basics?
Yeah, I suppose disability allowance is 254 a week, which is 13,208 a year. But the cost of disability is 28,860 a year. So it makes people that are on disability allowance and people with intellectual disabilities dependent on the state. And then carers benefit and carers allowance is means tested and taxed, and disability allowance is means tested, and carers benefit is 14,092. How do they expect people from families to look after their loved ones, but they're not giving us the
Well, it's
facilities
taken
and
as a given.
support.
You see, the thing is you're not going on strike, are you? You know,
No.
carers aren't going to organise themselves and down tools. You know, like, so it's like the army. You can do whatever you like to the army. They can't strike. They can't speak out. So, you know, not a bit wonder they're some of the. I'm sorry to conflate issues, but my point is when you sort of can't campaign or you can't strike, you get the worst deals. I know we've reached out, by the way, to various agencies in relation to this, as you would expect, Michelle, just to find out what the situation is. We were contacted too by Councillor Micheál Colm Ag Eileann Aspaig, who has been working with you, I believe, in relation to this. And, you know, there's not much either you or I could add to Michelle's words in terms of what she's doing and having to try and campaign for someone to be able to care for her sister and keep her independence. Once Michelle's unable to care for her, it's a terrible situation.
Yeah, I suppose we've never got
Sorry,
respite
I'm
either.
sorry,
I've
but beg your
reached.
pardon, Michelle. I have Micheál Colm to come in here, and I'll come back to you. I should have made that clear. My apologies. Go ahead, Micheál Colm.
Yeah, sorry, and you know, it's not that I'm working along with Shelley on this here. We do be in regular contact, but I suppose my kind of thing here is around the independent living. It's something that I've been working on and pushing for quite a number of years, and unfortunately, to date, we still don't have that independent living. And myself and Shelley would talk about issues like this here and how important they are, and you couldn't underestimate how important this is to a community, because there are a lot of people out there who I'm in regular contact with that have huge concerns as what if when this, you know, when their time is done, who will look after, and then having to depend heavily then on AHBs and then the HSE to try to come on board with the independent living, because we as a council, we don't have a function here beyond the fact of building a building within a house in the estate. So in Eric and Alan and the other house in the estate, Tihi Patrick Vale Arch, like, we need to make sure that we have independent living in all these new estates
so
that we build,
that
we are now building.
So how do we adjust housing strategy then? Because you know, there are planning applications going in all the time, which is good. So how do we adjust that housing strategy to plan for the future and to plan for Moira?
Well, I do think that now that independent living is something that is discussed on a very regular basis as a council, and I am hoping to see that there is an independent living built in Gidore, not just one but two. But we not you know, it can't be your tokenistic couple of ones here and there like we have in the Brinkbanks. We need to make sure that we have them everywhere where their need is.
Yeah.
And
how
one
do
of the
we do
other
that,
concerns
though, I
is,
wonder, Michal, because like, you will see welcoming, you know, 25 houses, a planning application has gone in here, you know, 160 houses there. Hopefully they come to fruition, right? But we are seeing these planning applications go in. What needs to happen at council level to make provision for independent living? So in other words, if these contractors go in there, these developers, and they're going to make an absolute fortune, it's not charity. How do we ensure that part of that is a percentage of that housing to be for independent living? Because that's the only way.
So when it happens is when a contractor comes in, and I don't agree with this model, but that said, when a contractor approaches the council, then we're in a position, and I have to give recognition to our house and local staff who have a genuine interest in this and has been in quite a lot of work on this, is that we're saying, hold on here, these are the needs, so we need a two-bedroom, we need a three-bedroom, we need a four-bedroom or a five-bedroom. So we dictate the need because we obviously know the need, and an independent living building is what we also need. So, but for that then to happen, you need the HSE involved, you need AHBs, need that be family and friends locally or one of the national organisations throughout the 26 counties. And there's been a fair bit of meetings taking place over this last wee while, and even yesterday alone I spoke to the house manager about another meeting that we're hoping to have with AHBs very, very shortly. And the thing is that there is, like, if you take Shelley, who's telling her story today, and I'm glad she's telling her story, but she shouldn't have to tell her story publicly to try to bring tension to this here. And maybe as a suggestion, it'd be worthwhile that maybe if the minister and all the TDs, irrelevant of their personalities or their politics, sit down with Shelley and others and work out what is the best interest, because there's a number of things here. So not everybody will qualify, will say, for a house. So if you have your own home and then you're looking for independent living, do you qualify then?
Yeah. But you
because
see, rather
you have
than,
a home,
rather
and it's
than,
really
and I,
complex.
I
that
get
there.
Exactly what you're coming from, but what that approach is that approach is to sort of try and identify what needs are out there and then create loads of different solutions to that. What we need is more top down, where we recognise there is a percentage of the population that is going to require this type of care and support, and then factor that in to the HSE budget, factor that in to our housing policy, and actually plan for the future rather than going to waiting lists and trying to redesign you know, the housing that's, we need to accept and understand, and it's the same for an older population. We need to accept and understand that we know what's coming, we know what's there, and we need a framework that the that we plug into rather than trying to deal with Maura's situation and then a fella up the road who's got a completely different situation, because that's just whack-a-mole. We'll be at that forever. This requires, I think, a national minister and policy nationally and locally to accept that this is something we should be doing rather than firefighting and trying to resolve individual individual cases, Micheál.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's about all the agencies sitting down, but away scrambling, trying to find AHBs that genuinely have an interest in this year, trying to get the HSE on board. For example, there was we're fighting at the moment over 8 two-bedroom apartments that an AHB response have at Clonlea. Now, when that building was built, there was money given by the state, our money, taxpayers' money, to build that the ground floor would be handed over to the HSE. And I don't like, maybe this maybe isn't the PC correct terminology, but people who might be vulnerable in our community to be homed and have wraparound services. That building has been built for the last 15, 20 years.
Okay.
We've been promised about 3 years ago that them 8 two-bedroom apartments would be done, dusted within a short period of time. Here we are in July 2026, and they're still not finished.
Yeah, okay. And we've discussed and that extensively.
The real commitment here, isn't being put in place. And I think that there has to be a serious political will, and not politicians like me coming on the radio.
I think there has to be a societal will as well. I think we all have to.
I think there is, though, Greg, a societal will.
I'll tell you why there isn't, and this is no harm, this is a human condition. If I was talking about dog poo in Letterkenny Town Park, I'd be sitting in front of 400 comments, right? And as I say, this is not a criticism. It's just what people say, the public, what we say, and I'm amongst them. This is a red line. This is a disgrace. Michelle shouldn't have to deal with this. Maura shouldn't have to deal with this. Enough is enough. And, you know, we're going to really, really kick up a stink about this, but it's not going to happen.
I can only base it on my own experience, right, is that when I started highlighting the very need that we have in Gidore and you know, other areas obviously have it, Clonleal, Narasa, Naglanti, Adra, every area has it, right? And in fairness, I'll have to go back to acknowledge the work of the local housing staff on this here. But that said, when we went to the gates in Gidore to do a protest to make sure that we were getting the independent living that we badly need, 5 bedrooms, 1 in-house wraparound and 4 independent kind of living within that house is what we need in the area. And people did come out. People were very much willing. I saw people who landed who didn't have any skin in the game here.
I understand. I have to move on. Thank you very much for coming on. Michelle, we have a response for the HSC. I won't add insult to injury. Effectively, it's saying they can't comment, but if you want to complain, there's a form you can fill out, so I'm not going to insult you with that. But Michelle, we'll continue our inquiries. Thank you very much for joining us. Pass on our best wishes to Maura, and if we get any updates, of course, we'll be in touch with you.
Thank you very much, Greg. Thanks for listening.
Salam. Thank you. Of course, these dry conditions are wreaking havoc on water supplies around the country. Anthony Skeffington is Ishka Éireann's Water Regional Operations Senior Manager for the Northwest Region, and he's with us now. In fact, he's not. Sorry, I didn't take him, and I'll get to him in a moment. If you wish to be part of the programme, by the way, 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number. If you want to talk about that last issue we were discussing, or give us a call on 07491 25000. Right. Good morning, Anthony Skeffington. How are you keeping? Thanks for your time today.
Good morning to your listeners.
Right, I want to
thanks
just
for having me on.
No, it's important to have you on, and there's a serious message we have to get across. But there's going to be a level of frustration out there because people are going to be saying, as they're listening to us, it's raining all the time here in the Northwest, or at least that's how it feels. How could we be, you know, 2 weeks deep into a dry spell and seeing these type of water restrictions? So just to get that one out of the way whilst you're on the call, Anthony.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Look, we're grappling at the moment. We're continuing to manage water supplies across the country, the region, and in Donegal as this kind of period of dry, warm weather continues. Even though it has been good for the past number of weeks, it's only since the last number of days that the real hot weather has started to increase in the northwest and in Donegal. And this has manifested itself then in a sustained high demand for water in the county, and that continues to impact treated reservoir levels in some areas. So we've placed a number of water restrictions, nighttime restrictions in a number of these things. Those are highlighted, and go through those in a few minutes.
Yeah,
just go back and answer your question just on it. I was on your show, I think it was last year, and with a different set of circumstances. What we had then was a very dry winter. Our natural resources, our rivers, our lakes, didn't replenish. So we had no raw water to treat. This is a different kind of problem that we have. We have huge high demand now due to the very warm weather out in the network. We have enough water in our natural resources. So it's that high demand that's affecting the level of water that we can push through our treatment plants and get out into the...
What is that demand? What are people... I mean, they're not drinking it, okay? So it's not that they're drinking it and that's causing these great problems. So are there obvious things that when we talk of high demand that we're referencing?
Yeah, look, the main reasons are, I suppose, a lot of people do work outside now. You know, the weather is better. They do a lot of cleaning around the households. They water the garden. They turn on sprinklers. You know, I've seen a lot of paddling pools, swimming pools, you know, those plastic pools being filled up. They wash the car. They do enough of power washing and stuff like that. And that's all, you know, to be admired as well. But I suppose there's a limited level or amount of water that we can treat and get out there. So a lot of people, even personal hygiene, you know, people shower more and stuff like that.
So what is the difference then? What would be the difference between a hose pipe ban like we're seeing in the east and restrictions? Why don't we just go now to getting the message out there, listen, use water butts or try and avoid using your power washer as much, just to get that. But why switch the water off? So what is the strategic difference between this hose pipe ban versus overnight restrictions?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, and we're grappling with that at the moment as well. You know why? You know, we are considering that, you know, nationally, but at the moment we feel that, you know, restrictions in certain areas is enough. It's not that we're turning off whole schemes as well. It's certain areas of schemes. So we're trying to restrict the impact as much as possible on the households.
But
so
just what that means, though, because we're restricting water in the evening at night to facilitate the abuse of water during the day. And this means that people are losing water, or if they're in low pressure areas, it takes longer to go back. It pushes through, you know, sediment or whatever might be in the lines. It strategically, you know, why are people having to make these sacrifices to accommodate people wasting the water during the day?
Yeah, and another point on that as well is that it's a legal order, you know, and we have to ensure that, you know, that we have to justify that order. So we have to put certain measures in place first. We have to get out with messaging. We have to get out with maybe restrictions for a short period of time. And we build up into a water conservation order. So that's kind of the reasoning behind it. So, you know, it is a kind of a measure there that we can use. It is only for the private use of water as well, rather than the public use. So we have to be mindful of that as well. So these things come into consideration. I'd also add, you know, they say in farms and stuff like that, and a lot of Donegal is rural as well, you know, that we'd be appealing as well to the farming community to ensure that they look after water supply in their areas, you know, that if there's any troughs leaking or stuff like that, that they report those into us through our either through, you know, the call centre 1800 278 278.
Yeah, but when we talk, I mean, obviously people are saying about the car washing companies and farming and what have you. You know, there is a certain level of activity that is all year round. When you start getting pressure on water, though, it's extra use of the water or abuse of the water, and it's predominantly, I imagine, in the private sector.
It's across all elements of the of sectors, I would say, you know, and I think we have to be mindful of water conservation, not just during summer periods, but all year round. You know, I think it is a finite resource. And in a lot of cases, you know, we're taking water from areas that we shouldn't really be taking water from. And that was highlighted in a piece of work that we did a couple of years ago called the National Resource Plan. And that's, we're kind of looking strategically at that. And where are the best places to take water from so that we're not impacting on biodiversity and the natural resource as well.
How far away do you think we are from water conservation order? I know we're going through a process at the moment. There's no rain forecast for 10 days at least. So how, in reality, how far are we away from a water conservation order here in Donegal?
Again, it all depends on the on rainfall and when we're likely to see that. We'll certainly be considering it. We'll be building up the case for it in the background in case we require it. Say if this period of warm weather, and it could continue for the next two, 3 weeks, you know, we'd certainly consider it then. But like at the moment, what we're trying to do is manage the supplies the best we can by just kind of restricting areas and then making sure that people have enough water during the day. So we're continuing to do that. I would, one other thing that I would ask is that if there's any leaks or anything like that, that the public come across, to please report them into ourselves at 1800 278 278. That's our call center, and we'll get those fixed as well, and make sure that if there's any leaks across, even in the private property, we'll have a look at those as well.
What is our leakage rate at the moment of treated water? It used to be in the mid-40s. Is it still in that
It's about 40% at the moment. We have a huge network up in Donegal. We have, I think we have about, I think it's 8% of the network, the entire network of Ireland. We've only probably 3 or 4% of the water supplied out. So say we've 69,000, I think it's about 65,000 kilometres of water main across the country, which is a huge amount, you know, enough to go across the equator of the world 1.5 times. You know, it's a huge rural kind of network that we have, that we apply out to. So it takes a lot of effort to find the leaks. Leaks are things that don't present themselves. First are.
Yeah. Well, one other thing, and I'm going to go through the areas affected because of time, Anthony, and it's not your fault, it's mine. Data centres, right? My understanding is data centres, they're a big drain on electricity, and I know they're not necessarily in our area, but maybe Meta's an outlier. But generally speaking, data centres aren't a massive drain on our water supply because they use air cooling and circular water. So just to put that to bed, this isn't about data centers. We could talk about power, but neither you or I want to mix water and electricity, right? data centers aren't the issue here. In Donegal, but even in the country, Anthony.
They use less than 1% of water.
All right, okay. Listen, I'll go through the areas that are affected now. We'll keep listeners updated going forward. We might touch base with you again in a week and see where we're at, because it's good to have access to you and get the facts. Thank you. That's Anthony.
Hi, Greg.
Regarding water restrictions, can you ask the rep from Mishka Éireann what time restrictions will run in Drumkeen Convoy area? If people are at work until 6 p.m. and not home till 6:30, have to eat, shower and put a wash on, then turning everything off at 8 p.m. is very restrictive. So at the moment, that Loch Mourne water supply 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. The Falkara water supply 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. Letchamacha Ward 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. Ballyshannon 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. It is early, 8 p.m. 8 p.m. to, I presume, is that you're being affected by the Loch Mourne water supply? Does it go up that way though? It does, yeah, of course. 8 p.m. Yeah, you're right. I know what you're saying. It seems very early, doesn't it? Very restrictive. And I think we're going to see more restrictions, overnight restrictions, and I think it's inevitable that we're going to see a water conservation order. Let's hear from a listener who sent in a voice note to us.
We are considering.
Hello. The reason that there's a shortage of water at the moment
In Port New, our drag, Glenty's area the other night, water was folded, shortage of water, preserved water. Is that every holiday home, every caravan, every bed and breakfast, and every apartment has been let out for this lovely good weather? And people are showering twice a day instead of maybe only once a day. They're boiling kettles more, maybe, and different things. That is why there's a shortage of water. And it has nothing to do with the water supply or anything like that. It's just a huge demand because every house, as I say, and all that is occupied at the moment.
Yeah,
thank
of
you.
Course, that is. And thank you indeed. Your voice notes, more than welcome to us on 0860 25,000. Maybe it suits you to message in that way. There is, but I mean, you know, we are a tourism county. Should we not, my friend, have greater capacity to deal with these issues? Independent Living says, and listener, isn't about requesting other people to come and help. People's rights are all about independent living, not agencies. They're about individuals who have the right to vote. I'm disabled myself. People with disabilities are individuals and should have the same rights as everyone else. Of course, and I really do appreciate your contribution. And it was probably me that was mixing up, you know, people that require additional help and support. And there are lots of people, but I do take your point. And I think Michelle was making that point really quite quickly and really quite clearly in relation to her sister. What about the elephant in the room? 40% lost through old pipes. Yeah, and I would say not just old pipes too. I'd say there's some new pipes leading into old pipes that are leaking as well. That's the problem. 40% of our treated water is wasted. It's lost. It's frustrating. A caller says, I think that the high demand for water, especially in the Downings area, is because we've another hotel. We had three now. We have four. There are thousands in caravans and Airbnbs who might be showering three times a day. Hotels should urge residents to conserve water. Visitors need to be told. We want tourists and businesses, but we don't want the water to go out. Well, you see, the infrastructure should match the facilities, shouldn't it? You know, that additional space, it's another 14 rooms. It's not going to, I don't think it's not going to break the bank in terms of water pressures, is it? Why don't we hear about the hose pipe bans in Australia, Spain and warm countries like that? We clearly aren't spending enough on water storage and conservation for a country that's over 200 days of rain per year compared to those warmer countries. Well, we take our water from effective bowls in the ground that seep. You know, we gather rainwater. Isn't that really what we're doing? These other countries certainly couldn't rely on that. So they have different ways of getting the water. They get it from underground sources, etc. So they just have a different way of doing it. I had my wee man at the beach yesterday afternoon. Lo and behold, cut on his foot, a piece of glass, sickening indeed. We made our way to the beach yesterday and Ashing got glass in her foot as well. Despite the best efforts of trying to clean the place up, people smashing bottles left, right and centre. Right, so we have to look after ourselves in this weather. We have to look after our skin. It's our biggest organ. It is an organ. Mary Ferry, owner of Genesis Guidor. It's a very valuable asset, our skin. It keeps everything together, doesn't it? And we do really need to up our regime at this time of year.
Yes, Greg. With the weather, we want to enjoy it and get out and, you know, make the most of it. But it's just so important that you wear your sun protection before you go out. And the thing that the people need to remember is that there's two different types of sunscreen, and they're classed as chemical sunscreens and physical sunscreens. Well, the physical sunscreens are the ones that contain the minerals, two minerals. It is titanium dioxide and zinc oxide. Now, if you check the ingredients and has that in it, then that's way more effective. And the reason it's more effective is because it's a mineral based. It's going to sit on the surface of the skin and it'll reflect the UV lights, the UVA light and the UVB, so it doesn't penetrate. Whereas if you just have a chemical sunscreen, you rub it on, it penetrates the skin, it goes into the bloodstream, creates heat, and then it reflects the sunlight. So it's just not as effective.
Yeah, so it's fast absorbing sunscreen, probably the latter then. It's sold as an advantage.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm. And what is the fundamental difference, though, in terms of the type of protection you get? Because both might have, you know, factor 50 written on them, for an example.
Well, with Greg, if you see the titanium dioxide and zinc oxide in the ingredients, that means it's mineral-based. That means it's going to sit on the skin on surface and reflect. It's like a mirror reflecting off the damage.
And is that one less waterproof? Because that sounds like it might be easy to wash off, where the one that soaks in might offer you protection if you're in and out of the pool or sea, for an example.
No, it can do both, but regardless, even if it says waterproof and sweatproof, I know you look for those ingredients. You look for that wording on any sunscreen, but like realistically, you have to reapply. If you're sweating, you're in and out of the sea, it's no sunscreen is 100% protective anyway. So you need to reapply every few hours, two, three hours, you have to reapply.
I know people are supposed to use sunscreen all year round, but perhaps they don't. So if people have a moisturising routine, how does the sunscreen factor into that? And let's presume they don't have moisturisers that might have some element of sunscreen within them. So, people want to look after the skin as they do on the daily, right? But they also want to have additional protection for the sun. What goes on first? What way do you manage all of that to ensure you limit your breakouts and maintain your good skin?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think most people need to change up the skincare routine in the summer, because in winter you would wear a heavier moisturiser and, you want to have an SPF. Regardless, if your moisturiser doesn't have an SPF in it, then apply it on top of the moisturiser. So you're going to cleanse, you're going to moisturise, then put on your SPF on top of that. But in the summer, everybody should change up their moisturiser to a nice light base moisturizer, water based or gel based, because if it's heavy, number one, you're going to be sweating, there's more oil in the surface skin, more dead skin cells, then you've got a heavy oily base moisturizer on top of that, and all of that just clogs the pores and then causes what you're seeing a lot of now is milia, little whiteheads from the skin. So that happens in the summer with heavy moisturizers, wrong ingredients, artificial colorings, and heavy makeup, and it's quite common. It's quite common. You'll see a lot of it now, right after the sunny spell.
So people should not be surprised if they spot these little whiteheads, these milia popping up. They are common. So what can people do to I presume to prevent is to mix up the moisturiser, as you mentioned there, but to treat after the fact, and maybe if they're going to then replenish their moisturising supply, how do you alleviate them?
Well, what happens in the sun as well, your skin will generate like nearly double the amount of skin cells. The turnover of skin cells will increase during the summer months and when the sun is out. And if you don't exfoliate, like gentle exfoliation, maybe once, twice a week, and use a lighter product, then they're going to occur. You're going to see them. And what's happening is they're very similar to a blackhead. So if you look at a blackhead, the blackhead is sitting in the pore. It's black in color. But with the whitehead, it's very similar. It's sitting in the pore, but it's covered with dead skin cells and it can't get out. And it's white in color. But if you were to pierce it, it turns black. Because it's not oxidized. But really, to remove them, they can be microlanced out, and or even using very gentle current to just open them and then scoop them out. Don't do it at home, because you can end up bursting vessels. But it's an easy enough treatment. But then again, there's no point in doing the treatment unless you're to discover what's causing them. Mm. So whoever, you need to check out.
That's what a consultation would help with, wouldn't it? Because
exactly.
You can sort of say, right, it's this. This is what you need to do going forward, and this is what we need to do right now. How important is hydration, drinking water? It can't be overstated, can it?
No, I don't think so, because, your skin needs to be hydrated from the inside out. And when we're applying moisturiser to the skin, that's just going on the very surface, the very epidermis surface, outer layer of the skin. So really, we need to consider drinking lots, especially in this weather, to hydrate from within, just to give you that nice glowing skin. Plus, if you're dehydrated, your skin will look good. It'll look tired, look dry, flaky on the surface, and no glow to it, just dead looking. So yeah, it's important to definitely hydrate. Not even just in this weather, like always.
Yeah, but you can learn good habits at this time of year too. You see,
yeah,
that you can
exactly,
carry through,
yeah.
Right? And I know you're a big advocate for vitamin C serums.
Oh, I think vitamin C serum is really important. Like, it's not everybody has it, not everybody uses it, but if they could start to incorporate it into their daily routine, after the cleanse, they could put on the vitamin C serum. And the reason being is because vitamin C is going to protect from the environment and protect from the damaging rays. Now, especially UVA rays, because it penetrates deep, deep into the skin. And that's what breaks down our collagen and elastin. Whereas the UVB really is just on the surface, and that is going to cause sunburn. So the two different things, but at least if you had the vitamin C serum on, that's going to help bounce it back and, you know, reflect it off, so to protect the skin even more.
Okay.
And then you would put on your moisturizer and SPF.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you so much. Yeah, and if you want any further advice or even a consultation, because you don't want this to be guesswork, you can contact Genesis Guidor, Mary Ferry and her team. Thank you so much. Enjoy the good weather.
Lovely. Thanks, Greg.
Bye.
Thanks, family.
It's hard to put a timeline on it, but there was a point a couple of years ago where we just says, right, e-scooters, here's the legislation, you know, limited restrictions in relation to them. If you're 16 years of age, you can effectively travel pretty much every road in the county. You don't need a helmet. You don't need any training. You don't need anything. Just you can't have a seat. You can't carry passengers. You can't carry luggage. You can't go over a certain speed. Other than that, really, it was like they're just bikes. But unfortunately, data is showing that e-scooters have become a leading cause of traumatic brain injuries in children admitted to the National Neurosurgical Centre, often resulting in extensive intensive care stays, emergency neurosurgery and life-changing complications. As we've been hearing today, the Taoiseach's indicated a strong preference for a total ban on the use of e-scooters. Well, Dr. Anya Keating is a consultant in emergency medicine at Letterkenny University Hospital. And I suppose we're not legislators, but, you know, you're dealing potentially with the aftermath of this. Doctor, what are we seeing?
Yeah, hi, Greg. Thanks for having me on the show this morning to discuss this kind of public health matter, I suppose. So, yeah, we have seen an increase in e-scooter-related injuries since the kind of introduction of e-scooters. I appreciate that they are a convenient way of getting around. However, they have risks because it's a motorised vehicle and often people don't wear helmets with them and they don't appreciate that because they're going at high speed. If they collide with someone else or another vehicle, that they can incur serious injuries. So at the minute, we are seeing an increase of injuries related to e-scooters come through. They can vary, they can minor cuts or abrasions, but they can all go all the way up to serious head injuries. And, you know, there, it's been such a concern and such an alarming level that this is now the leading cause of traumatic brain injury in Ireland at the minute for children, that the neurosurgeons and the surgical team down in Temple Street have asked for a total ban on e-scooters because they just don't, they see that this is a totally preventable injury that shouldn't have to happen.
In terms of admissions or presentations at Letterkenny University Hospital, is it significant in number? Obviously, one significant, but listeners will understand the question.
Yeah, we are seeing a rise in scooter-related injuries here. Mainly what we're seeing are broken bones. Fortunately, we haven't seen too many catastrophic head injuries, but it only takes one case. And, you know, it's always the kind of saying is when they come in, prevention is better than cure. Once you have that head injury, it's life-changing. It's very, very difficult to, you know, reverse that. So it's better that if they haven't been on the scooter in the first place, you know, and sustaining that head injury, so it's just trying to protect people. So it's the same, I suppose, with cars years ago. You know, people didn't wear seatbelts until we brought the legislation in, and we've seen a massive reduction in injuries and fatal injuries from cars because of that. So things have become safer, and sometimes we just need to kind of put that safety mechanism around it.
Mm. I've spoken to people working in this space in Dublin, and you can get mixed views on helmet use, you know, and perhaps that's why it's not mandated on bikes or on scooters. You know, there is this sense that amongst the general public, if you're wearing a helmet, there's no head injuries. But as I say, the people I've spoken to down in Dublin that work in this area on the show, it's not black and white, you know, that just extra protection doesn't mean we'll see, you know, less cases even.
No, I think it is important that if you are on any type of bicycle even or motorbike, obviously, and even these e-scooters, it is important that you should wear a helmet. If you were to have a head injury at that point, it would prevent it probably being catastrophic. You may get a minor head injury, but hopefully it wouldn't be as severe. Mm. But unfortunately, I think the issue is that because there's just been such an increase, maybe parents aren't aware that they're totally banned in under 16s, that these children should not be on them whatsoever, that hasn't been adhered to. Maybe the Gardaí are having difficulty enforcing that law as well, so that they're looking for a total ban at the minute.
Yeah, and in fairness to the Gardaí, they've limited resources, and to put an entire new vehicle and level of enforcement on top of that, it's a big ask. And while we are seeing an increase in injuries here, Doctor, the reality is it's almost like a percentage. The more of these scooters we see, inevitably, the more injuries we'll see. And I don't know. It's just a fact of life, isn't it? So the greater the adaptation here, be it rural or urban, the more you're going to see coming through the front door of Letterkenny University Hospital.
Yeah, and I just suppose I kind of want to appeal to parents, especially, that these are not toys, that these are motorised vehicles. They can travel up to 20 kilometres an hour. That carries a lot of energy. And if you fall into concrete at high speed, that is a totally different injury from falling off a simple scooter that you're pushing yourself or a bike. So just please be aware of that. And we have to protect our children. I know as adults, we make our own decisions and we are able to do that, but we have a responsibility to protect our children. So if I can appeal to parents today, if you're thinking about getting one of these for your children, that they are very dangerous types of vehicles. And, you know, if they were to be hit by a car unexpectedly or they were to fall off it, they could have serious life-changing injuries. And honestly, the one thing I can say to people is prevention and safety is better than cure, than coming to me in A&E trying to patch you up.
Yeah, and I don't want to scare anyone, but I just want to reiterate, you know, like you can get a severe bang to the head and you can go into hospital, you can be patched up and you can be let out and externally things might look as they did before that. But, you know, trauma to the head can change personality, mood, can trigger other things. As I say, I don't want to scare people, but doctor, we do want to make sure people understand the consequences of a severe head injury.
Yes, absolutely. That's 100% right.
Okay. And would you join your colleagues in being in favour of an all-out ban?
At this moment in time, given the fact that it's the leading cause of traumatic brain injury in children in Ireland, yes. I feel that if the government are to look at this and, you know, they were trying to actually enforce and enact the actual legislation that is there, I know we would need probably a higher Garda presence and Garda support around it. So
but in the absence
it really
of that,
is up to the government. Yeah. In the absence of that, then yes.
All right. I know you're very busy down there, so I shan't hold you any longer. Bye-bye. Yeah. Dr. Anya Keating there, consultant in emergency medicine at Letterkenny University Hospital. And I suspect just as that call ends that she's probably going to go on and give someone some very important care. Right, let us get back to our voice messages now. I have two screens, but the one thing that annoys me about windows is that they open in different places. You know, you open up a window and it pops up on one screen behind another program and it all gets really blummin' annoying. But anyway, right, let's hear from this listener who wants to talk about Irish water.
I personally think the biggest reason why we have water shortages, it has nothing to do with the amount of people in our county. The amount of rain we get a year should be substantial enough for the lakes and the rivers and what we have to supply water. The biggest issue is we have a company called Iske Éireann running it, and they're not capable for the amount of leaks and old pipes in this county alone, in Donegal, not counting the rest of the country, is unbelievable. The amount of leaks, and don't get me wrong, they inherited bad piping and bad stuff from the council, but Iske Éireann's at fault here, nothing else. Iske Éireann has a lot to answer for, and I think a lot of people should be fired on this, because it's down to all the leaks is the biggest issue in Ireland.
Do you agree or disagree? You can WhatsApp or text 086 60 25,000. Give us a call on 07491 25,000, or send your voice notes to WhatsApp on 086 60 25,000. Yeah, so people in the Loch Mourn supply, they're losing their water at 8 p.m. and then it's due to come back at 8 a.m. But if you are in a low pressure area, it might not come back until after that. And it's not like power. You know, if the electricity goes off and they flick a switch, it's on. And it's on and working from the moment that switch goes on. Water more complex because it has to make its way, to every single house that's on that line, not to mention the 40% that's just running into the ground. Viola is with us now. And, you know, you have been told your water's due back on this morning. You are in Lifford, but no water.
No water, Greg. I agree with that last caller there, 100%. As the Avery's water is a disaster. It's not just this week. My water has been going off last week and the week previous to that. Now, I'll start with the week previous. I rang Avery's water and explained that this wasn't good enough. It just wasn't good enough at this day and age. And they should have a backup. They should have a plan B. They didn't have a plan B. The water came on, but the pressure was very, very low, which didn't run my shower upstairs. Mm. I rang Irish Water back and explained, I'm going to be left without a shower if I don't get the pressure on the water. So an engineer from Irish Water rang me and said that he would call out to see why the pressure was low. But after 5 minutes of that phone call, when I turned the shower on, the shower was back to full capacity of power.
Right.
So he was able to just click a button.
Mm.
I rang this morning. I rang twice this morning to Avery's Water, and the girl passed the message on, Now, you couldn't get that engineer that contacted me 3 weeks ago to contact me. And I said, I have an appointment this morning, which I had to cancel due to the lack of not being able to get showered.
Yeah.
I said, it's not good enough. Do they realise that we're going through a heat wave here? And it's not good enough. At this day and age, it's not good enough.
And Viola, too, you know, like you've been told that these restrictions are up until the 17th of July. You and I might have been born at night, but not last night. You know that you could be facing into a month of this.
They're saying it's going to... The alert message that I got said from the 9th of July to the 17th of July, and it was going off at 8 o'clock at night, and it was coming on at 7 in the morning. My water hasn't come on any of those dates at 7 in the morning. It's now, what time, 10 to 11, 11 o'clock, and my water's still not on today. And I now have another appointment in Letterkenny at 1:30. And so, I'm sitting here with no water, being able to get the shower.
No dishwasher if you had one, no washing machine, and no shower.
It's not just the shower, Greg.
Yeah.
No, you know, people just might forget to fill a kettle at night. As there's young children running around, what if they run out of bottled water and the weller that's in it? We all need to keep drinking. It's just not my share. It's the whole, it's everything to do with water.
Yeah.
It's very vital, especially when there's a heat wave. Avery's Water needs to now look at plan B. Everybody has to have a backup. No matter what it's for, you have to have a backup. Mm. And we seem to be the only county in this country that just, disaster is the word for it.
Yeah.
And I just cannot honestly see it getting any better. We're not going to complain at all about the weather. Everybody's loving the weather. But, you know, we've had enough rain for months that we don't need rain just at the moment. We do need a certain amount of it, for farmers and crops and all that.
But you're looking, Viola, if the truth be told, in 3 weeks' time, we could be talking about flooding in the Lifford area. You know, or Riffo. You know what I mean? That's the truth of it. It's hard to get our head around, especially when 4 out of 10 litres are actually treated and lost. Viola, we'll get on to Uisce Éireann and see what they have to say. Hopefully, whatever button was pressed, although it could have been a coincidence, that's sorted. But anyway, we'll see.
I said to the girl, I know where the tap is. I can go and turn it on for everybody. I know where it's at. I said, I can go and turn it on.
I'll be out working for any water after this.
Oh, would you stop? No, thanks in that. All right, Fiola, look after yourself. Thank you.
Again, right.
Thanks for contacting us. Well done to all involved in getting the lovely beach in Downing's cleaned. Maybe charge cars 5 or 10 euro to go on the beach, and then there could be a litter warden employed and maybe offset the cost of cleaning the beach and disposal of the rubbish left behind. Well, listen, I'm not speaking on behalf of anyone here. The people of Downing's know best. But yesterday, the beach was packed, absolutely rammed, and there was cars on the beach, and it was families, and it was people on holidays, people away from the day. There was no boozing, there was no rallying, there was no speeding. It was a lovely atmosphere. The beach had been really well cleaned, though there were still remnants, but you couldn't get all of the glass. And then you say, right, you know, there was a lovely sense of community and people chatting to each other and people out on their surfboards and, you know, kids happy and having fun in the water with their families. And that's really what our beaches are like all of the time. And as I say, maybe I'm wrong and I missed stuff that maybe happened later. What happened at the weekend was something different. This was people that came in to use and abuse the space. And, you know, we talked yesterday about should cars be banned full time from the beach. Well, then you saw yesterday and, you know, it's really handy for parents. I saw a family with a child with additional needs. And, you know, the family were able to get down right to the water's edge and that child was able to have the full experience of being at the beach. Older people who perhaps maybe would struggle to walk down there, sitting in their cars, chilled, living their best lives in retirement. You know, so I think yesterday really is what our beaches are all about there and wherever you were. And what we saw at the weekend when people just come down to treat it as their own dumping ground. You know, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater either. If you're in that area or any area, you agree or disagree with me, let me know. But as I say, our experience yesterday was exactly what going to the beach in Donegal is all about. Yes, it's busy, but everyone's respectful of each other, you know, enjoying the water. And as I say, because cars can go onto the beach, it changed my mind yesterday when I saw this young girl being able to enjoy the water as she was able to. It changed my mind on vehicle access to beaches. I sit in this seat, right, and it's you guys and my life experiences that change my views. I'm not hard and fast on anything. I was thinking, you know what? What we need to do is deal with the problem and not throw the baby out with the bathwater. The video of rubbish being lifted from Downing's Beach is shocking. However, the council needs to provide amenities for tourists and locals. Bernadette, I appreciate your text, but you could not have provided anything for the weekend. You really couldn't. What should have happened is, with an abundance of caution, beaches that you can drive onto wherever they are in Donegal should have been locked on Friday evening. See what happens, see who lands, see what the crack is, and then make a decision from there. And I would expect that perhaps people will have learnt the lesson. Not people, like individuals. I mean us, the local authority, the guards, whomever it might be. Mary Herlihy is manager at Donegal Women's Centre and joins me now. Good morning to you, Mary.
Good morning, Greg. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, have you welcomed or are you welcoming the government's approval, the cabinet's approval, in fact, of new legislation? And this will provide 5 days of paid leave for women who experience a miscarriage before 23 weeks of pregnancy. It's an issue we've discussed quite a lot on this programme, and here we are. Is it the right move?
Absolutely, Greg. It is the right move. And we've been waiting for this for quite a while. And I've been engaged in having conversations with the relevant people around this. A pregnancy loss at any stage is devastating. And I suppose after 23 weeks, there were certain things in place. There was leave. There's a different entitlement after 23 weeks. But it was that before the 23 weeks mark that was really concerning. It was where women were having a loss to different circumstances. And it was the shame that was around it. It was the secrecy. It was not being able to talk about it. It was almost a taboo subject. And yet having a loss such as a miscarriage and then having to get on as if life was normal, you know, go back to work, looking after the kids, just pretend that life was normal. And actually there's been a really devastating loss to her medically and emotionally and, you know, in a relationship and all of that. And that has never been discussed. And we still don't really discuss it. So this is a great first step to talking about miscarriage.
Yeah, and indeed. And it facilitates, you know, potential medical procedures that would be required after a miscarriage. Alternatively, the woman would be expected to take unpaid leave or book time off. So this takes account to the medical realities in cases as well.
Yeah, and 5 days is great because it does allow for those appointments to take place. That follow-up that is needed. Not all miscarriages are straightforward. You know, so there's many different complicating factors that come into dealing with a miscarriage. It's not just that you have the event happens and you move on. There's a lot of follow-ups, you know, and there's GPs, there's everybody, there's the hospital, everybody's involved in her care. So to have that time without having to take unpaid leave or compassionate leave, annual leave, you know, or whatever was would have been an offer before, really supports that in a compassionate way, which is what is needed.
The woman obviously would require a medical certificate, which would have to be furnished to the employer. And in fairness, now it's the employer that pays most of this money, my understanding is.
Yeah.
And obviously then that would, you know, that would divulge the fact that she had a miscarriage, but there's no other way around that, really. I mean, that just, and you know what, you know, me even posing that question talks to perhaps the stigma around miscarriage in the first instance, right?
Yeah. Well, that's it exactly. I suppose there has to be a method, there has to be a process to this. And I think that the fact that a miscarriage has to be disclosed for most people might be a relief, and it might be a sense of support that the employer actually acknowledges, you know, that I was pregnant, I've lost the pregnancy, and they're there to support me. We're hoping that it's going to facilitate more conversations, maybe some more training and awareness bringing in the workplace. You know, as long as there's no other details having to be divulged, it is being treated like any other illness.
Yeah. The medical search should cover it. There should be no follow-up questions.
Yeah. No.
And it's up to the woman to make the choice, of course. Everyone handles different situations differently. You know, there's not one size fits all in this regard, and it depends at what stage the loss is or whatever. There's a myriad of so this is for those who need it, and there are those who may feel they don't need it and they approach things in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, at the Women's Centre here, we're all about choice. So it is for those women who, if some women will have a miscarriage, and for whatever reason, they can go back to normal, their normal life, you know, pretty straightforward, pretty quickly, and don't need any support at that time. That's not to say it won't happen at a later stage. But for most women, they will like that support, that time, just to process everything that's going on. They've been thrown into a grieving process that they haven't expected. You know, it's part of them that they've lost. So they have a process to go through, and they have, you know, probably medical care to follow up on. And it's just to give that space, that time to acknowledge, look, there was a life here. I was pregnant. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked out. And, you know, but I have these days now in my employer. And it means then I can actually be honest by what has happened. I don't have to say, oh, I had the flu, or, you know, kind of cover it up. Yeah. So it is about taking out the shame and the stigma around miscarriage.
Some listeners may be surprised to learn that if a woman chooses to end the pregnancy, i.e. an abortion, that they would also be entitled to 5 days unpaid leave. Now, maybe there'll be a crossover of emotions, a different range of emotions. I simply don't know. The Donegal Women's Centre, do you also support women who have an abortion getting 5 days paid leave?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Without a shadow of a doubt, there shouldn't be any difference between the both. Abortions take place for many, many different reasons. And, you know, and this new leave shouldn't be taken over by any debate around abortion. It's there. It's legal. And that woman is entitled to the same leave, to the same care and protection and compassion from the state and from her employer and her co-workers as any woman who has had a loss. So, and that is between her and her GP and her medical team. So it's really important that there's no difference made between somebody who has chosen a termination for whatever reason, and there's many and very varied.
Yeah, I know, but there's also there is. Mm-hmm. So, but there's also 10,000 or 11,000 abortions a year, and we know that they're not all for because of rape or fetal abnormality. But you as an organisation and you as an individual are glad there isn't. And in fairness, the state themselves, the government says that they didn't want to differentiate. Okay.
Yeah.
Mary, thank you for your time. Look after yourself.
Thanks a million, Greg. Take care.
Okay,
thank you.
Good luck. Mary Herlihy there, who's manager at the Donegal Women's Centre, 086 60 25,000. We have no end of comments today. I have to say, and they are all equally appreciated. And if I don't get to them, we don't censor comments. The only way we'd censor a comment here is if you're going to get us into trouble for libeling someone. Hi, Greg. Completely agree with that lady from Lifford regarding the water being turned off. I'm here in Convoy, and the exact same happens here. Our water is turned off when the sun shines for a couple of days in the summer, and even in the winter when there's a bit of frost. Washing machine and shower is not working because the pressure is too low. It's not good enough. I live 3 miles from Port New Beach. I agree the water problem is the fault of Irish Water. They put up a notice. The water restrictions is from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. But the water in my house is off from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. So no water all day. Wow. On that last topic we just discussed, do not equate miscarriage with abortion. Abortion is the intentional killing ending of your baby's life. Miscarriage is a loss of life. That's not a choice. And any medical care during or after miscarriage is not abortion. But that's not the you make that differentiation. The law is at this point not. Greg, could you ask what's the story with hedges being cut along the roads? I've never seen them so bad. I don't want to ask. I can't. It's so complicated. Landowners are responsible. The council can go in and bill landowners. Landowners are afraid that if they cut the hedges that they could be done for damage to wildlife. There's disagreements between adjoining landowners. It's so complex. I don't know what the story is. And I was trying to get to the bottom of what is a policy, what policy can we have? And there is none. We talked to the IFA. They said you can cut hedges back at this time of year, you know, if there's a danger to traffic on the road. But at the same time, you could get reported and you could have the Wildlife Service around saying that you're doing this, that and that, and you could face fines and investigation. And you cut someone else's hedges, you could get into bother for that. Listen, we'll return to it. All I'm saying is it's complicated. And that's where we have to leave it on the show today. Have a fantastic day, everyone. Stay safe. Really mind the water if you're out and about, please. And enjoy the good weather. Enjoy the good weather. Heed the warnings, but don't let them put you off.